Just a few moments, I want to say a word about the deep appreciation we feel for Frank and Isabel and their being willing to be here with us away from home and family. And I want Frank and Isabel to know how much they have refreshed our hearts and increased our faith and strengthened our spirits by being here today. And so we're looking forward to Frank Worgan of Manchester, England, to speak together to us again this morning. And if you're visiting with us and have not heard Frank, we know that you will be impressed by his love for the Lord and his knowledge of the Scriptures. But we wanted Frank to know anew this morning how deeply appreciative we are of him and the good work he's doing among us, as well as all of the others who work for the Lord at this place. Brother Frank Worgan.
Can I put this gadget on? After that introduction, I'm reminded of one of our English visitors to the United States who received such a warm, effusive introduction that when he stood up to speak, he said, "I can hardly wait to hear what I have to say." But I do. We really do appreciate the love and the kindness that's been shown to us. I'm not sure that I agree with that last song, Brother Song Leader. There are many warm hearts in this congregation, and there are many people whose faith is strong, and I'm delighted at that. And I hope that in our fellowship together, hope you don't mind me saying this, I know you don't. In our fellowship together, I hope we're going to be bound closer together in the Lord and made stronger in Him, so that a powerful witness will go forth from this congregation. I'm going to let you into what I call a trade secret. That's a preacher's secret. I'm going to let you into one of the inner things in a preacher's life. I'm going to tell you of my problems. I have a problem every time I stand up to preach. The problem is, what shall I tell them? What shall I say? Now, it's absolutely true, and I believe it's true of anyone who ever undertakes to speak for the Lord. The problem of deciding what to say. And so this morning, what shall I say? Shall I deal with the problems confronting the church? Shall I talk about the difficulty of witnessing in a world that is becoming more and more materialistic? Shall I, for example, talk about the challenges that confront the church today? Shall I talk about the fact that we ought to be more active, more evangelical? Shall I tell the brethren you ought to pray more, you ought to give more, you ought to study more? I'm sure you've heard all of this before, you see. So I've decided not to do any of those things. I want us to look away from ourselves, look away from each other, look away from the problems and the difficulties that confront us, and let's look at God for a change. Let's have a look at our Heavenly Father and stop thinking about what we ought to be doing and look at what He's doing for us, what He's been doing for such a long time, and what He's willing to do for us. And for that reason, I want to talk about a subject which I suppose every Christian claims to believe in, but which I think very few of us put into practice. I want to talk about the providence of God. And to do that, I want to go to the passage that was read to you this morning, Exodus chapter 1, because there we see the phenomenal growth that was experienced by the Israelites when, along with Jacob, the family of 70 went into the land of Egypt. The opening verses of that chapter record that they grew strong, they didn't add, they multiplied, and they filled the land. Now that's in verse 7, and that's phenomenal growth by any standard, and it has to be accounted for. So how does the historian account for the growth? Well, I think you get a hint of that in verse 5. He says, Joseph was already in Egypt. Now, you might be saying to yourself, well, what's new about that? We've had it about Joseph for the last 14 chapters in the book of Genesis, beginning at chapter 37, right through to the end. It's been all Joseph all the way. Why does it have to now tell us that Joseph was already in Egypt when we know it? Now, that's true. But it is the fact that that made the difference when Jacob and his family went into the land of Egypt. The fact that Joseph was there already preparing the way for them, getting things ready for them. Now, let me remind you how it came about that they were in Egypt in the first place. They went to Egypt under the pressure of a terrible famine. If you go back to the book of Genesis, chapter 47, verse 54, you discover there was famine in all lands, but in the land of Egypt, there was bread. And by the way, at that time, there were still 5 more years of famine to come. So this is the situation, famine. And Jacob hears that there is corn in Egypt. But the solution to the problem is not as easy as that. It's a situation beset with difficulties. And those sons of Jacob did not really contemplate a shopping expedition to Egypt at that time, I can tell you, for very good reasons. Let me give you just 2 reasons. That will suffice. First of all, there was a physical reason. Just bear in mind that the distance from Hebron, where they lived, to Tanis in Egypt, was all of 500 miles, and it was an extremely hazardous and extremely dangerous journey to make. That's number one. But there was also a political reason, and it is that ever since the days of Abraham, the Egyptians had been suspicious of visitors arriving at their northern border. As a matter of fact, they had built a series of forts and a wall across the northern border. Outposts were there, and daily records were sent of visitors arriving there, sent into the capital. Records as to the number of visitors, as to their disposition, as to their attitude. They were extremely suspicious. Now, although that dynasty that had erected those forts and that wall had now gone, and Egypt was still under the benign rule of some foreign kings known as the Hyksos, or the shepherd kings, who were of Semitic origin and consequently favorable to Joseph and to his family, the practice was still carried on. The daily records were sent of the arrival of visitors into the capital. And the sons of Jacob understood that when they got to the wall, there was no guarantee that they were going to be let in. Incidentally, you'll find the word wall, which is the word sure, at least 3 times in the book of Genesis. You remember, for example, when Hagar, the slave who had displeased Sarah, ran away. They found her in the wilderness of Shur. Now, remember that Hagar was an Egyptian woman, and she was going back to Egypt, and they found her in the wilderness of the wall, the wilderness of the wall. So imagine that, these sons of Jacob possibly arriving at the wall of Egypt and discovering that they're not going to be allowed in. They would have made a wasted journey. So that's the situation they're confronted with. However, the scriptures tell us that the situation became so acute that it became a matter of life and or death, and they simply had to make the journey. Now, let me condense the story. To their amazement, they eventually discovered that the man in charge of the food in Egypt, and in charge of just about everything else, second in command in the entire land under Pharaoh, was their long-lost brother Joseph, or at least the Joseph whom they had sold into slavery years before, and whom they now believed to be dead. The story has a fairy tale ending, as you know, but it's not a fairy tale, it is a fact. The outcome is that eventually Jacob and his sons came along to Egypt. They were given land in the area of Goshen, which incidentally is pretty close to where Cairo is today, the most fertile part of the Nile Delta, and there they lived in prosperity and in security and comfort. And I suppose in later times they would look back and they would laugh at themselves for the anxiety they felt in those distant days. Now then, the question is, how did it come about that Joseph was in Egypt? Notice I'm not asking why, because you know why. You know very well that Joseph was sold into Egypt by his brothers. They hated him, there was jealousy there, and I suppose that in their hearts, would have to admit that, they simply wanted to get rid of him. That's one possible explanation for the reason why Joseph was in Egypt. There's another explanation that Joseph himself gives in the 45th chapter of the book of Genesis. Joseph says to them, "I am your brother whom you sold into Egypt. Do not distress yourselves because you sold me, for God sent me before you to preserve life." God sent me before you to preserve life. On the one hand, you see, human judgment would say, well, Joseph was in Egypt because his brothers hated him and wanted to get rid of him, and that was absolutely true as far as it went. But Joseph gives the real reason. Joseph sees the significance in his being sold into Egypt, the significance in all that's happened to him. And he looks at that and he says, I see God's hand here. God's hand was in this from the very beginning. God sent me ahead of you to preserve your life. So here are two facts. Joseph was already in Egypt because God sent him ahead to prepare for his people. Now, I think that provides us with an excellent illustration of how the providence of God works. Joseph looks at the chain of events in his life, and he says, now this, God's hand was here from the start. Now, I don't know how long it took him to learn that. I can well imagine that a lad of about 17 years of age, having the fearful experience of being hated by his brothers and sold into slavery to the Midianites, and then sold on to Potiphar, a captain of Pharaoh's guard, I don't think he would have the wisdom or the insight, the experience at that stage in his life to be able to recognize the hand of God in this. I don't know how and when he came to realize it, but the fact remains that God's hand was there all the time. I don't think anybody looking at what was happening to Joseph at that time would have seen and understood that God was doing this for the purposes of his people. And let me tell you what the purpose was. You remember that God made Abraham several promises. One was the promise of a son, through whom all the nations of the earth would ultimately be blessed. The other promise was the promise of a great nation. And there was no way in which the Israelites could develop into the kind of people God wanted them to become, a mighty people, if they remained nomadic shepherds wandering around looking for pasture all the time. They had to come to some place where they could develop and send down roots and grow into the great nation that he wanted them to become. And Egypt was the place at that time. The richest, the most prosperous country in the world. So, what are we looking at here? We're seeing that God's hand was preparing the way for his people. Now, the theologians have a rather expensive kind of word to describe this. They speak of the prevenient grace of God. Now, the word prevenient simply means going on before. It means anticipating. It means preceding. We ordinary mortals use a less expensive word. We use the word I've already used this morning, the word providence. It means the very same, because the word providence is from the Latin, and it means to provide before. Now, you think about this, will you? Do you believe in the providence of God? Providence, God going before, God preceding, God making preparation, God ahead of you all the time, God preparing your way, God getting things ready for you. That's what the Bible teaches. And you see that all through the Word of God. You see men experiencing this instrumentality of the hand of God in their lives. That's why Joseph was already in Egypt. Now, providence is something that is characteristic only of God. You can't even use the word in a human sense or to applying it to any human being. It only applies to God. And why is that? Well, it's the fact that God is all-knowing, that God is all-powerful, that God is omnipresent, that makes it possible for him to anticipate and to go on ahead of you and make plans for you. Without any one of these qualities or characteristics, there could be no such thing as providential dealing. For example, suppose that God didn't know everything. Suppose God could not do everything. Suppose God could not be everywhere present at the same time. Well, he might miss something because he didn't know about it. Or he might know about it and not be able to do anything about it because he didn't have the power. Now, I'm not talking about predestination, by the way. I'm not talking about predestination for salvation. I'm talking about God's providential care for his people, which the Bible is full of. And it's because God is God. It's because he possesses these qualities that he does know everything, that he can do everything, that he is everywhere present at the same time, that makes it possible for him to provide beforehand for you and for me. And I'm glad that it's this way, because since God is God, Joseph is always ahead of us in Egypt. He's always there. For example, I referred quite recently to Genesis 28, the time when Jacob had to run away from his extremely angry brother Esau. And I told you about Jacob being there in the wilderness, away from home for the first time, in a strange country, with a stone for a pillow, late at night, and having an amazing dream. And you remember what happened in the morning, what he said? He said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." But God was waiting for him. God anticipated him. God was there. Jacob renamed the place, didn't he? Originally, the name of the place was Luz. And he renamed it Bet-El. The word Bet in Hebrew is the word for house. The house of God. He named it the house of God because God was waiting for Jacob out there in the wilderness. Or coming over to the New Testament, think of Acts chapter 12 when the Apostle Peter has been arrested by that wicked King Herod who intends to kill him the next day when the feast is ended. And Peter's in the inner prison, dark and damp without any windows. He's fastened on either side, chained on either side to soldiers, a soldier on either side. And he's sleeping there in that prison cell. And then something happens. A messenger of the Lord, an angelic being, comes along and thumps Peter in the side. Yes, he thumps him. He hits him in the side. He didn't say, "Shh, wait a minute, Peter. Shh, wake up, you know." There was no whispering there. He hit him in the side. That's what it says it. And everything is so calm and so orderly. "Peter, get up. Now put on your sandals. Put on your cloak and follow me." And Peter said, can you imagine the amazement, the consternation experienced by Peter at that moment? I've no doubt he realized what's supposed to happen. I'm sure he understood that he was supposed to be leaving the prison. But it seemed an impossibility because quite apart from the two soldiers in the cell with him, there was a second guard and there was a third guard, and no doubt there were guards at the iron gate at the entrance to the prison. It was normal for them to have a quaternion of soldiers, 16 soldiers looking after a prisoner like that. And I can imagine Peter in a daze going out and saying, "This is simply not going to work. It won't work." But what happens when they get to the outer gate? The iron gate opens of its own accord, and Peter finds himself in the early morning light out on the street and amazed at what's happened. And he said, "Now I know surely that God has sent his angel to deliver me." Well, you see, God was preparing for Peter. Joseph was already in Egypt, so far as Peter was concerned. Or another instance. Think of the time when those two women went to the tomb early on the morning of the resurrection. What was the conversation they had along the way? What were they discussing? What was the problem they were confronting? Well, you know what that was, don't you? Who is going to roll away the stone? Now, that was a massive problem, a massive stone. The stone was rolled into a groove that had been carved in front of the entrance to the tomb. Very easy to roll the thing into the groove, but an extremely difficult task, certainly for women, an impossible task for them to roll the stone out. And they're concerned about this. But when they get to the tomb, Joseph is in Egypt before them. Because God has anticipated them, the stone has been rolled away, the entrance to the tomb is open. The providence of God. Doesn't it by now occur to you, brethren, that if we could have faith in God's providential care for us, for his people in every age, not just in the Old Testament, not just in the New Testament, but in every age, if we could learn to trust the prevenient grace of God, the grace of God that goes on ahead of us, it would free our minds of many anxieties, and we'd lead more tranquil lives. God's methods have changed, but there's been no change in his degree of concern for his people. And that means you and me today, born into his family, born of God. Let me remind you, Job says, he knows the way that I take. And when he has tried me, I shall come out as gold. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he will direct thy path. The ways of the righteous are ordered by the Lord. Now that holds true for our whole life on earth. God knows our way, and eventually, though not necessarily immediately, you'll discover that God has been working things out for you. You may not always understand what he's doing in your life. You may not even like what he's doing in your life sometimes. You may not enjoy what he's doing in your life. But nevertheless, your life is in his hand because you're his child, and he's looking for the best for you. You can guarantee that God will work out, well, what is the passage? All things work together for good to them that love God, who are the called according to his purpose, Paul says in Romans chapter 8. And by the way, let me suggest too that this is also true when it comes to preaching the gospel in our evangelistic work. Sometimes we're very uncertain and very hesitant about this, aren't we? Let's say there's somebody to whom you'd particularly like to speak about Jesus. Maybe somebody facing a great problem, a great turmoil in his or her life. Somebody who's facing a trial. Somebody who's bearing a heavy burden right now. Now, you say to yourself, well, how would he take it if I spoke to him about spiritual things? Will he resent it? Will she be annoyed? Shall I meet with a rebuff? Will he even understand what I'm trying to say? Well, bless your soul, he will understand what you're trying to say. Because, you know, it's amazing how when we speak to people about the Lord Jesus and about spiritual things, we seem to touch a hidden spring in the heart that opens up to reveal depths and feelings that we never imagined were there. We don't understand how it happens. Somebody once said there's a God-shaped place in every heart. And you can understand that, can't you? A place that only God can fill. Since God made the human heart, God knows what will move it, and the gospel is designed to move people's hearts. You've heard of Helen Keller, I'm sure. Very great personality. When she was 19 months old, she became totally blind and totally deaf. Now, can you imagine the kind of affliction that is? I imagine it must be terrible to be blind anyway. To live in a world of darkness. But to live also in a world of silence. Couple them together. In total darkness, in total silence. What a terrible experience. And so they tried to teach this child. A lady called Anne Sullivan eventually devised a means whereby they could communicate with her. And they chose Phillips Brooks, the preacher from Boston, to try to tell her about God and tell her about Jesus. And he tried to make her understand that there exists a God who cannot be seen, but who loved her. And he signaled that in some way to the child. And she replied in the same way. A smile illuminated that little face. And she said, I have known about him all the time, but I didn't know his name. Is that amazing? Who told that blind and deaf child about God? How did she come to understand it? But she did. Joseph was there before Phillips Brooks. Some time ago, I was in Aberdeen in Scotland for a series of gospel meetings. The church had asked me to talk about the church. And there was one gentleman, Stanley Wilson, about in his 50s, attended every service and became increasingly interested in the gospel and in the church.
He eventually told us
that he belonged to the worldwide Church of God of Herbert W. Armstrong,
which you also may have heard. And
he had for many, many years, for at least 30 years, been studying the scriptures and was convinced that we should be observing the Sabbath, and he would like to talk about the Sabbath,
he said.
Well, that just about that time I had to return to England,
and Brother John Nisbet, working with the church in Aberdeen,
prepared to have a discussion with Mr. Wilson on the Sabbath.
Joe
wrote me a letter later,
and Joe said
that he spent hours going over his material, over his arguments on the subject of the Sabbath. He said,
I prepared to meet a lion.
But then the letter continues, however, I met a lamb, and a sweet and gentle lamb at that.
He said that after 2 years, Stanley thanked him profusely for having taken the time to talk to him,
and he accepted what the Bible taught
on the Sabbath.
You see, his heart had been prepared for the truth. Our brother Joe had been wondering what to expect. But I say again, Joseph was already in Egypt. And because he was willing to speak to Mr. Wilson, that man's heart was willing to listen. And today the man is a very useful and effective member of the Lord's body, having obeyed the gospel in Aberdeen. Let me finally suggest to you that God is preparing your future. Not only does he go ahead of you preparing your way in life, but the grand message of the gospel is that God is ahead of you, that Joseph is ahead of you, preparing your way there. Didn't Jesus say in John 14, I go to prepare a place for you. It's not very long ago, they were celebrating the 300th year anniversary of the death of John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, which, if you haven't read, I think you ought to read. It's a beautiful book. It's an allegory of a Christian's journey from earth to heaven. And towards the end of the book, he describes Christian arriving at the last great river and looking across and seeing in the distance the palace of the king. And when he looks, he sees there are two lions there outside the gate. And his heart turns to water, and he's afraid. But he finds the courage to go on. And when he reaches the palace, he discovers that somebody has chained the lions up. The king is expecting him. Joseph was in Egypt before him. And we know that when we come ourselves to that last great river, the great frontier, we'll discover that Joseph is already in Egypt. Our Jesus has gone on ahead for us. He's prepared and he's waiting. And there's no reason to be afraid. I mentioned in one of the classes recently that Dr. John Bailey, who's a medical doctor, wrote a book called And the Life Everlasting. And he's speaking of his experiences as a Christian doctor. And he tells that on one occasion, he went to visit an old saint of God who was very close to death. And the old man asked him, can you tell me anything of what to expect after death takes place? He was very concerned, very apprehensive about it. And Dr. Bailey said, I thought for a while. Then he said, I heard a scratching. Something scratching at the bedroom door. And I realized what it was. And he said, I said to our brother, do you hear that? That's my dog. I told him to stay at the bottom of the stairs and wait for me. But he's heard my voice in your bedroom, and he's come up the stairs, and he's outside your room. Now, he doesn't know what's inside the room. He doesn't know what it's like in here, but he knows that I'm here. Isn't it like that with you? You don't know what heaven's like. Oh, you have some hints in the Bible, some beautiful pictures painted in the book of Revelation. You don't really know what to expect when you get there. You don't know what is there, but you certainly know who is there. Because Jesus has gone to prepare a place for you. You remember, too, that the writer of the letter to the Hebrews says, Jesus has gone into heaven there to appear before the throne of God for us. Now, I don't know what Jesus is doing in heaven for me, not all of it anyway. I know some things that the Bible tells me. I know that he's my mediator there. But I don't know what he's doing to prepare the place for me. But I'm satisfied to know that he's there. Where Jesus is, that is heaven. And it'll be wonderful to get to heaven to see him. And he's preparing a place for us. I find great comfort in these words, believe me. I know that he's in heaven. I know that he says, I'm going to get it ready for you. I know that one day he'll come again and he'll take me to be with him. So then, Joseph, already in Egypt, are you going to the hospital shortly? Are you going to hospital shortly? Are you anxious? Well, Joseph's already in Egypt. God is there. Are you beginning a new job? And you're sort of looking with trepidation towards starting in a new environment. Joseph is already in Egypt. God is there. Do you anticipate moving to a new country, perhaps? And you don't know what it's like? Joseph is already in Egypt. God is already there. Never, never, never forget, brethren, that great promise to which I have already referred. We know that in everything God works for good. In everything. Do you believe that? In everything God works for good to those, for those who love him, who are the called according to his purpose. And Paul continues in that 8th chapter. What shall we say then to this? If God is for us, who then can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but freely gave him up for us all, how then will he not along with him freely give us all things? Who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? And by the way, in the Greek, what follows is a series of four questions. Who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? God who justifies? Jesus Christ who died? Who is it who condemns? Who shall separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril of the sword, and you may add to this, sickness, disease, suffering, bereavement? Nay, in all these things we are, again the Greek, overcomers. More than conquerors in the English translation, but overcomers through him who loved us. And he said, I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor anything in the whole of creation, the modern version says, shall be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. Joseph is already in Egypt. In England we sing a song that's not in your book. The words are these: God holds the key to all unknown, and I'm glad. If other hands should hold the key, or if he trusted it to me, I might be sad. What if tomorrow's cares were here without its rest? I'd rather he unlock the day, and as the hours swing open say, my will is best. The very dimness of my sight makes me secure, for groping in my misty way I feel his hand and hear him say, my help is sure. Enough. This covers all my wants, and so I rest. For what I cannot, he can see. And in his care I safe shall be. Forever blessed. If you're subject to God's invitation today, we invite you to respond right now as we stand to sing.